Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
The 12-step program for addiction, is it still relevant? Is it a program that is still helpful for those struggling with addiction today, including food addiction? Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your host today, speaking with Dr. Michael Cowell Gordon. Dr. Michael Gordon is a family physician and an addiction specialist who practiced in Wisconsin and Georgia for over 50 years until he retired last year. He completed his medical training at the University of Illinois College of Medicine in 1967 and received his board certification in addiction medicine in 19. Inspired by his own recovery journey, as well as those of his patients, Dr. Gordon has dedicated much of his career to understanding and treating addiction. He is author of the book, The 12-Step Pathway, A Heroic Journey of Recovery, which is a collection of individual stories demonstrating how people struggling with addiction can embark on a transformative journey of recovery using the 12-step program such as Alcoholics Anonymous. By utilizing the metaphor of the hero's journey as conceptualized by Joseph Campbell, does offer a journey of recovery that is motivating and inspiring for all addictions, including those of us in the trenches of food addiction. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Thank you. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your own story, both as a physician and your work, how you got into this field?
Yes, thank you. I've wanted to be a doctor since forever. My mother says I was probably 10 years old when I started talking about it. And there were no doctors in my family, although my parents were both professional people. And so I got into medical school and I graduated in 1967, University of Illinois. My plan was to be an internal medicine specialist and possibly subspecialist, maybe gastroenterology, maybe hematology. I really didn't know oncology. It was all interesting to me. But in my senior year of medical school, I met a gal who I wouldn't say we fell in love, but we got mutually attracted to each other. And I had a plan of going up to the University of Wisconsin and doing a medicine internship. And so we went up there and she had a mental breakdown. And part of her mental breakdown involved a delusional belief that I was going to abandon her. And it put tremendous pressure on me, so much so that I was not able to focus on my studies. I took a leave of absence from the internship, and eventually I resigned it because she had started psychiatric treatment and it was just not getting any better. I became horribly depressed, became alienated and estranged from my family who didn't understand what was going on with me. She began taking pills and her condition got much worse. She was taking amphetamines to get going during the day and barbiturates to go to sleep at night. And when that supply ran out, she used alcohol. We had a terrible time. And I was trying to fix myself. I saw a psychiatrist, but he was not helpful. And I stopped seeing him. She was seeing a psychiatrist and he was not helpful. And I tried religion. I'm Jewish, so I figured, let me try, see if I can solve my problems by a more serious practice of my religion. And I did that for a couple of years without benefit. It didn't improve my life any. So then I thought, let me try her religion. She grew up as an Episcopalian. So I tried that religion. And while I think it was beneficial in some respects, quality of my life didn't improve. I had a terrible quality of life. I thought about killing myself every day. And it's just a miracle that I lived through all of that. Eventually, she left the marriage and it gave me an opportunity to recapture my life. And I had gone back, I had managed to complete an internship at the University of Wisconsin in pathology. And I'd become interested through all my personal experience in alcohol. And I thought, let me start a family practice, but I'm going to focus on alcoholism. And I didn't really know much about AA, but I was invited to go to an AA meeting by a fellow who was aware of my interest in alcoholism. And he thought I could be an asset to the recovering community. I could help with treating the alcoholics. So I did that. My first AA meeting that I attended as a guest was November 17th, 1972. It was the year after Bill Wilson died. And so I was at the meeting, and it was in downtown Madison, Wisconsin on a Friday night, where you would think everybody would be partying. And I was in a room full of maybe 80, 100 people, all of them alcoholics and all of them sober and all of them joyful, having a good time, just being really happy to be there with each other in that community. And there was three guys that came down from Green Bay to tell their stories. Each spoke for about 15 minutes. It was very powerful, let me tell you. And I thought, this is the answer. This is how people recover from alcoholism. And I saw a wall hanging with the 12 steps enumerated. And I said, well, this is how it works. This is the recipe for recovery. I had not, in my experience with religion, found a recipe for recovery. I found worship and prayer and this and that, but no recipe for how to live life. And with that start, I became a great believer in the power of AA and the power of Al-Anon, the family programs, and other related programs. And I started seeing alcoholics. I started a medical directorship at a detox center. And then a fellow opened a program the following year, asked me to be medical director there. So I did that. And from really 1973 onward, I have been actively involved in addiction treatment as my primary profession until last year when I retired. And so I heard you say in your opening, is AA still relevant? Absolutely.
Before we talk about that more, let's go back to that first meeting in 1971 or two. Yeah, you were so moved by, hey, this is a solution. But just to be frank, what other solutions were there at that time? You were moving into the field and there wasn't much by way of medication or even alternative treatments. What was there and how did the AA speak to you as a program of recovery versus the other things that were available?
You're right. There wasn't anything else really available. We had antabuse back then, which had limited usefulness.
Yeah.
It's far from a comprehensive program. We had psychiatrists, but they weren't trained in addiction. They didn't understand it. You had some social workers, but they didn't really get it either. In fact, there was, I don't know if you remember the Rand Report back in the late 70s, I think. In fact, it came out of Canada, the Bells.
Yes.
They
moderate drinking.
Yeah, they showed in their research that alcoholics could be taught to drink moderately. So that was a quality of help that was available. And of course, you had the state hospitals. And as far as other addictions, heroin addicts, there was eventually methadone clinics. But there was nothing available. You're right.
But over the years, things have changed. There's been a secular alternative to AA in the addiction world that's very much focused on medications. Cognitive therapy, did you use in your work with clients?
Yes, but I didn't try to treat the patients myself. I did my parts, and we had addiction counselors and psychologists, social workers, rec therapists. We had a whole team of people, and I think that's what you really need to do the best job you can for people. There are people that decide to quit drinking and go to AA and they succeed, so that's fine. But by the time they needed a lot more help than that.
So over the years, did your opinion about the value of AA get strengthened, or because there were more alternatives that were coming forward?
Yeah, so nothing that came forward diminished my belief in the power of AA. I think a lot of alcoholics have additional problems, let's say depression and anxiety, for example. And they've gone through trauma and they require medication. They may be bipolar. They may have other issues that need to be addressed. And that's a lot of what I did. We have anti-craving agents now, like naltrexone, which I think is quite effective for some people. And I find it extremely helpful for behavioral addictions like sex and gambling and shopping. naltrexone is a real powerful tool. There are other medications that have been tried, and I'd say fairly effective, not what you'd like. People are complicated. An alcoholic, you can't say, okay, there's one thing wrong in the brain, and that's what we fix. That's not what it is. It's a complex disease that has psychological, emotional, physical, and spiritual dimensions, and they all have to be addressed.
It sounds to me like you're saying that you believe in the power of AA, but you also use complementary treatment as well to address other issues.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What was interested in your experience with using Caduceus groups, which was an example of professional groups outside of the AA model that still use some of the principles of group therapy. What was your impression about those, especially for the people who just didn't want to do AA?
A lot of people don't want to use AA, and some of them recover using other methods. Most don't. In fact, even if people use AA, a lot of times they don't get it the first time, and they may not recover at all. It's, as I said, it's a complex disease, and it's just not every solution works in every case.
Okay.
Caduceus groups. When I came to Georgia, we had a very active recovering doctors program.
Which is, by the way, for listeners, a Caduceus group is a recovering health professional program.
And so we had at the Ridgeview Institute, Dr. Talbot's program, and I was not directly involved with them, but I saw some of the doctors that came through that program in a tangential role. And I was invited to come to the Caduceus group, but they had there once a week. And I didn't like it. I didn't like it. I felt that they were abusive in their approach to people. They humiliated people, and I just didn't like it at all. So I didn't continue with it, but I think it helped some people. There are people who respond well to the drill sergeant approach, and I'm not one of those people. And a lot of people don't do so well with it. They just tolerate it until they can finally get out of it.
Yeah.
But I think other Caduceus groups are much healthier and can be of real benefit to doctors. And I think this is not AA, this is peer support. When you identify people that you have something in common with, especially something about being an addicted doctor that can create quite a stigma and create a lot of shame and fear in people. There's a lot of fear of losing their license, for example, or not getting it back if they did get it suspended. It's a challenging thing to have to face in life.
Yeah.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Hey, Food Junkie listeners. Have you read the book Food Junkies Recovery from Food Addiction yet? It all starts there. This is the book with the basic theory and clinical knowledge of food addiction. Read this book first to get the basics. Our Food Junkies podcast jumps off from the book and is the ongoing breathing version, ever growing and ever expanding. Our podcast introduces you to all the issues of food addiction and the who's who of food addiction today. And if we at the Food Junkies podcast have inspired you to action, either to quit sugar or some other triggering foods or behavior, and you need some extra support, then please join the free Facebook group, I'm Sweet Enough Sugar-Free for Life. There you will find a community of people who come from all parts of the spectrum, from the new and just starting out, to the long-timers who call themselves food addicts in recovery, to counselors ready to give back and help you. The Facebook group even offers free support Zoom groups. Basically, it's a great online living resource of food addiction to help you stay sugar-free for life. So please join us.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
I can say that my experience of the Caduceus group was I saw people coming into a setting, like you say, under the threat of losing their license, or this is the only way that I can maintain my license. So there was a lot of griping in the group, a lot of frustration in the group. And then the AA experience of people, you said, laughing and feeling joyful. And it was just like almost a night and day experience. Maybe it depended on you had to be in a good group, but it did have a definite feeling of darkness or moodiness versus lightness and thriving.
Yes, there's a cloud hanging over their heads.
Yeah. So let's get into your book. You alluded to how you were introduced to AA as a positive force for recovery. What made you decide, I want to write a book, and then using the Campbell story arc, as it were?
Well, like everything else, there's no just one easy answer to that question. But I had been practicing addiction medicine for about 20 years, and I was in Atlanta, in fact, at the Ridgeview Institute by this time. And Ridgeview had leased a wing of the hospital to this Christian program. They had mental health and substance abuse treatment using biblical principles, and they had their own counselors, but they did not have their own psychiatrists or addictionologists. And I worked with some of those patients. And one day I was called to see a fellow and be his doctor. So he was interested in making something clear to me at the very beginning, which is, I'm not a Christian, he says. I want you to understand that. But that certainly wasn't a problem for me. But I said, what do you believe? He said, first of all, I know I need to be here. I'm a cocaine addict and I need help. And my wife wants me to get help and she wants me here. So that's why I'm here. But what I believe, I'm a follower of Joseph Campbell. I said, okay. He said, have you heard of Joseph Campbell? I said, I have, but I'm not that well informed, so tell me what you believe. He said, according to Joseph Campbell, God is beyond all categories of human thought. And that being the case, there's no religion that has the lockdown on exactly who God is and what God expects and what God wants and all that. So he said, that's what I believe, that God is, it's not possible to think about God as God is. Okay. I was interested in that. And I went home and I got Campbell's book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. He wrote that in the late 1940s. And he talked about mythology and the heroic journey and how all cultures have their own heroic myths and their own heroes. And he said, it's such a pattern that they couldn't have learned it from each other. It's something innate within the human mind and the human psychology and the human society.
It's kind of like the Carl Jung's collective unconscious.
Yes.
Idea. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that Dr. Jung in his writings talked about the collective unconscious, which is it's the presence of beliefs, knowledge, attitudes, structures, social structures, and something that he called archetypes. An archetype is an image, a symbol, a belief that is held in common by people. But just to give you an example of what an archetype is, mother is an archetype. And when an infant is born, it has a certain response to the mother, which is innate. And the mother has a certain response to the infant. Infant is also an archetype. And we see this in the animal world, too. It's instinctive. It's natural. Another example of an archetype, which is more germane to what we're talking about, is the idea of God. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the primary text that was mostly written by Bill Wilson and published in 1939, he said that deep inside every man, woman, and child is the idea of God. In other words, the idea of God is an archetype, and it manifests differently. Exactly how this idea is held by people, that depends on their own experience. It depends on exactly how it was transmitted down to them. Depends on a lot of things. And about half the people that come into AA either don't believe in God or they're very undecided about what to believe. And there's a substantial other percentage of people that are mad at God, that think that God has allowed terrible things to happen. And the hero journey is an archetype. It's a way of thinking about life, and it's a way about going through life, which follows a certain pattern. And I thought that it really replicated recovery. Life is difficult and people get into terrible scrapes in their lives. A lot of it of their own making and some of it not of their own making. People don't walk into an AA meeting because they're doing so well in their life. People don't come into Gamblers Anonymous on a winning streak. And no addict walks into the program because they're doing so well. Their life is a disaster when they walk in. And so they can either think of themselves as an all-time loser, or you can be told, you know what? You can be a hero. Your life replicates a heroic journey. And where you're at right now is you've been in the stage in which you're called to the adventure.
Can you elaborate a bit on the heroic journey concept?
I will. According to Joseph Campbell, and by the way, the more you read about this, the more different ways it's described. But I describe it in this way because it works well in addiction recovery and it's straight from Campbell. He defines eight stages to the journey. And the first is a call to adventure. The call to adventure, I say, to an addict comes when you wake up and you don't remember how you got there. You might be locked up. You might be on the floor somewhere. Somebody might have beaten you up. You might be in bed with somebody you don't know.
Or in the food addiction case, you might be on the floor or hugging the toilet, feeling disgusted at yourself.
Absolutely. And you may be grossly overweight, and you may be grossly underweight, and you might be a normal weight. So all of those things are possible. But the self-loathing is profound. And this is the call to adventure. And the second stage is the refusal of the call. No, I don't. I'm doing fine. I don't need any help. I don't need any help. And this can go on for years. But that's the second stage. And getting past that stage is the acceptance of the call to adventure and say, okay, all right, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try this. And the hero is promised help. The hero doesn't have to do this alone. Can't do it alone. Needs help. And in the case of, let's say, Moses, who was called by God to go talk to the Pharaoh. Moses says, I can't do that. I can't speak right. And he's not going to listen to me. He said, I'll send your brother with you and I'll help you. So he finally gave in. So the third stage is where the hero accepts the call. In the case of recovery, somebody says, okay, you're going to treatment. And they say, okay, I'll go. And then they tell you in treatment, you need to get honest with yourself. I'll do my best. And here's a sponsor. You need a sponsor. Okay, I'll try that. Here are the 12 steps. Okay, I'll try that. Here's a food plan. Okay, I'll try that. And the willingness to do what you were previously unwilling to do. So from there, the actual adventure begins. And what's the actual adventure? There are two actual adventures. The first adventure, say for the alcoholic, is staying sober in the same world that they couldn't stay sober before. The world hasn't changed. The food addict is going back into the same world that he or she came out of.
Lots of food pushers saying, have this, have that.
It's there. And everywhere you go is food, at least in our society. And you walk into a convenience store and a gambling addict has the poker machines. And the alcoholic has the beer to walk by. And the food addict has all the candy bars to walk by or whatever it may be. Just a simple act of walking into a convenience store can be dangerous for some people. And they can't do it alone. So they have groups to attend. And when they go to the groups, they see people who are successful. And they say, I can do it too. If you can do it, I can do it.
So this is still part of Joseph Campbell's arc?
Yes, because it's the idea of accepting help. The other adventure that goes on at the same time is an interior adventure. This is the adventure where you take an honest look at yourself, good and the bad. And people are afraid to do this and don't want to because they're afraid of what they're going to find. They're afraid of getting honest. And again, they get help with this. Through the adventure, eventually, you achieve the quest. And what is a quest? It's self-love as opposed to self-hate. It's sobriety from whichever addiction you had, as opposed to compulsive and obsessive use.
It sounds to me like you're describing the 12-step program, but Joseph Campbell has said that if you accept help, then the archetype is that you can then expect to get on the other side.
That's right. That's right. I call it probably the fifth stage with the achievement of the quest. In the case of addiction, both total abstinence and also gone through a process from self-hate to self-love. Then there's the call to return. The sixth stage is the call to return. And Campbell says that the heroic journey is not just for the benefit of the hero, it's for the benefit of the whole community. In fact, he goes so far as to say that the purpose of the heroic journey is to redeem the world. Remarkable. Now, some cultures, the heroes come back with a method for cultivation of corn, for example. This is what the journey has brought them. But they have to bring it back, because if they know how to cultivate corn and don't teach their community, people are going to continue to be hungry. The call to return. The next stage is the refusal of the call to return, because now the hero is comfortable. What do you mean go back? I don't want to go back. I'm doing fine. And then the last stage is the return, bringing the treasure back to the kingdom, of going back and sharing your knowledge, sharing your strength with other people in your home community. And so this is a heroic journey.
And we see that in every culture, Jesus with the Christian culture and Muhammad with the Islamic culture, maybe Einstein.
Einstein was quite a fellow.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that the 12-step program mimics that through the actual steps.
The 12-step in particular talks about three things: a spiritual awakening, helping others, and being the best person you can be.
Tell us about your book in this context.
So my book talks about, first of all, it talks about Bill Wilson and some of the history of it. I have a chapter about addiction, explaining what addiction is. I have several stories in the book. I put in one Bible story, the story of the patriarch Jacob, because his story is quite powerful in terms of the mythic things that occurred in his life. I have eight people who wrote their own stories of recovery, of addiction and recovery. I have a chapter in which I analyze all the stories, and I talk about in what way they exemplify a heroic journey and in what way the 12 steps have impacted them on their journey. I have a workbook at the end of the book, which helps people work through this whole concept of the heroic journey and the 12 steps. And I have several chapters that show step by step how each step works to help people progress through their own heroic quest. So that's the structure of the book.
And why is it that it would be helpful for a person to utilize that concept towards their recovery?
I have at least two answers to that. One is, I think the more different ways you can describe the same thing, the better you understand it. That's one way. You can go see a therapist, and he or she can explain certain things to you about your life. And then you can go to FA or some addiction 12-step program, and they can give you a whole context that you can put your life in. And then if you can see how your life corresponds to a heroic journey, it gives you yet another way of thinking about yourself. I think one particular benefit is that most people would rather be a hero than a drunk.
Yeah.
And if there is one personality characteristic that I think is universally present among people in addiction, it's low self-esteem. People just don't like themselves. They're very guilt and shame-ridden individuals. They're hurt, they're angry, they're fearful. And on a hero journey, you say, okay, but there's a hero inside of you, and we can help you let this identify the hero and let it emerge. And you can be a hero. It's just better than being an ex-drunk. You can be an ex-drunk, but how about being a hero? This is a better thing. And it counteracts the idea of self-hate.
You can be a hero. It doesn't even matter where you are on that journey, because whether you accept or reject, that's part of the storyline. So
right.
It gives you a sense of hope that no matter where you are, there is another story moving forward. That's
right. And when people get stubborn and they say, I don't want to do that, you can say, this this attitude you have, this is part of the heroic journey. This is just where you're at right now. And we'll get past it and then we'll move on to something better.
The person that walks into the AA meeting and says, oh God, there they are talking about God again and higher power. You got an answer for that.
Yeah, my answer is don't worry about it. Let's face the fact that all these people seem to be doing quite well with their lives, and let's stick around and find out what that's all about.
What advice would you give somebody who is starting off in recovery?
I would say, let's go to the appropriate 12-step program. I'd probably say you ought to see a therapist as well, and just get your family into therapy, and let's use all the tools we have. See the doctor and see if there's an anti-craving agent that would help you, or see if you need to be on some medication for bipolar or whatever it may be. But in addition to all that, I would say one way of thinking about this is that you're involved on a heroic journey. And as we all are, life is difficult. And what we can do is acknowledge that, not think that we're worse off than everybody else. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Let's say, okay, let's find out about this. Let's see about this hero that you say I have. And let me just try to become courageous, face it, get whatever help I need. And if the help is through a 12-step program, attend a 12-step program, get a sponsor, work the steps and see what happens.
Can you do the heroic journey without the 12-step program for somebody?
Sure, yeah. Of course.
So what you're really presenting is a therapeutic template, or with a projection implied. Here's a tool that you can use, because what is therapy but just reevaluating your previous perceptions into a more positive one? And this seems to be a nice systematic structure template.
Said, thank you. Yeah. I have never believed that there's only one way for people to recover.
This book just came out last year. I would imagine, though, that it's been in your mind for some time and that you've been using the tools. Have you seen success? Have you seen that it's actually been a useful tool?
I have, but I've never had a book that I can direct people to. So in my counseling with people, we would talk about this, and I think people responded well to it, but it's nice to have the book for people to go and read some of the stories in it and see what they can relate to, and then come back and talk to the therapist about it. And I think it's going to be a useful tool for a lot of people.
I want to say that it's a therapeutic tool. That seems really apparent with our discussion. But when I read the book, I remember thinking, this is written by somebody who likes to write, likes to think. You have a lot of thoughts that come from writers, other literary allusions. It was just a pleasant read in the addiction world. For somebody who just wants to read about addiction and be engrossed in the literature of it, I thought your book did that really well.
Thank you. Thank you.
More than just the therapeutic tool is what I'm saying.
I've written one book previous, self-published a story. In 1992, my wife passed away. She had cancer and complications of chemotherapy is what actually killed her. And our daughter was 14 at the time, and it was a heavy blow. It was very difficult. I got through it, and I decided that I wanted to write about it. It was actually about 4 years later, maybe five, when I decided to write about it. And in order to make it interesting for myself, I decided to write a story instead of just, I don't know, a narrative. And it's then that I found out I could write. I didn't know I could write. I found out I could write. I didn't get a publisher, so I self-published it. I actually won an award for it.
Wow.
Yeah. But then I didn't write again. I was busy and nothing really struck me. I had some health problems come up in 2019, and that was really the impetus for me to close my practice. And so I got therapy and I was doing better. My immune system was impaired through this whole process. And then COVID came along in early 2020, and I was faced with not being able to go out. I went out to take walks in the neighborhood, and I went to see the doctor, and that was it. I didn't go to a store for over a year. I didn't go out to eat. What am I going to do? I'll write another book. And what am I going to write about? And I thought about it and thought about it. And then one day, I'll write about recovery as a heroic journey guided by the 12 steps.
In a way, you used your story about the loss of your wife, too, as a kind of heroic journey you gave back after you...
Yes.
accepted and went through all that pain. It's a way of living, isn't it, this approach?
It is. We're social animals, people are. And in the societies in which we live, I use plural because you have your work group and you have your family group and your neighborhood group and your church group or your knitting group or whoever you're associated with, and we relate to each other and we help each other. That's what we do. It's part of being human.
I'm wondering if we can go to the concept of the, I guess, the wounded healer, the impaired physician. Do you think that having an experience in the field that you're working in is of value, and or could it actually be an impediment? Because especially in the food addiction world, most of us who are in the front lines are there not because of previous training, it's because of the essentially having recovered in some version of that story and wanting to give back. But is that in and of itself a good motivation? Just what are your thoughts about that?
Of course, it's a good motivation in the spirit of bringing the treasure back to the kingdom. There are great many people that need what you have, healers in food addiction, a great many people that need what you have. Of course, that's good. The patients or clients, however you think about the people you're helping, will benefit from a sense of not being judged by their therapist. I think it's possible to convey to somebody that you're treating that you're not judging them, even if you haven't gone through food addiction yourself. But there is that piece that I think can be beneficial. Where can it be a problem? I think some therapists may overshare, talk too much about themselves, give too much information out that a patient doesn't really need to hear. So that's a potential problem. I think the therapist can get codependent on their patients and try harder than the patient.
That's a good phrase.
I don't believe in working harder than the patient. I'll work hard, but I'm not going to work harder than you are. If you don't want to do it, don't do it, and we'll see what happens. So you can get codependent. You can get too involved in somebody's life, personal life. And that's a potential risk.
What about the other, which is you don't have any experience in that field? Do you think that somebody can do as good a job basically just being book smart?
No, I think you have to have human experience in life.
Yeah.
And if you're so psychologically constricted that you don't know how to relate to other people, you just have book knowledge, you're not going to be a good therapist.
I would imagine that you wouldn't extend that to, they have to have the experience in that field. Like, would you, not having an issue with food, be able to help somebody in food addiction? You have lots of experience in addiction in general.
I agree. You don't have to be a recovering food addict to be an effective food addiction therapist.
But it's good if you have some experience somewhere along the line of being a human being with all of the struggles and recoveries from those struggles.
Yeah, and you have to be a non-judgmental person. You can't look down on people and think, oh, you shouldn't be like this. You should have known better.
Okay. Now, what about the physician? I'm sure you've come across this in your work, where somebody's working in the field, let's say in addiction, they're still using. But what do you think about them? Should they be still in the field, even though they're still using?
I guess there's two scenarios, one of which they're supposedly in recovery and they're really not.
Or they're not saying they're in recovery.
Okay,
it's none of your business, basically.
They're just living their life and go home and have a few drinks and...
Or a few too many.
Or way too many. And No, I think somebody who is in the grip of an addiction is going to be impaired and not be 100% there in the therapeutic way.
We see this in the food addiction world where people come into the field. This has been my experience. They're therapists already. They have those skills. They're intrigued by the fact that, geez, maybe I should quit my food. So I'll go in the field and help people. And somehow along the way, even though I'm not recovered, I'll absorb the recovery myself. But they're still not recovered.
That would never work.
Yeah, I don't think it works either. But I see that happening.
I can't use my patient to help me get better.
Huh.
That doesn't do anybody any good.
Have you ever had the experience when you hear somebody talking about maybe the latest new drug that has tweaked your own curiosity in a way that's potentially dangerous?
We haven't gotten into this, but I decided many years ago that I was better off not drinking. And so I don't drink. And I don't honestly think there's anything that could get me to drink. I'm very happy with how my life is going right now.
So there was nothing that ever tempted you?
No. The latest thing is psychedelic treatment of addiction.
Great example.
Yeah. I'm not going to pronounce judgment on psychedelic treatment. I think there's research going on and we'll see. Bill Wilson got into it through his involvement with Aldous Huxley and a couple of Canadian doctors from Saskatchewan. He was just trying to find another way of helping alcoholics, and he exercised poor judgment, which some people do at times. And he came under a lot of criticism for it, and I think rightly so. But that doesn't say that there is no potential benefit to psychedelic treatment. I don't know. I'm a natural skeptic. I have to look at the literature carefully before I would say this might be worth trying. But then the idea, I could take an acid trip. I don't want to take an acid trip. I like my life the way it is right now. And I'm aware of how powerful drugs are and what they can do to people. And I don't want to be one of those people that had something happen that really didn't need to go through that.
Okay. All right. Good. What is next for you? So you've retired, you've published your book. What are you hoping to do next in relation to your career, your life?
Three things. One, I want to live as long as possible, and we'll see how that goes. I'm working on another book.
You are?
Yeah. And the book is about seeking a higher power. I mentioned earlier the percentage of people that come into treatment without any good relationship or understanding of a higher power that works for them. In the AA literature, it actually says, Bill Wilson wrote, that there are three things that became clear. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Not if he were found, if he were sought. And people come in and I think could use a manual for seeking God. This is a way of going about it. Or these are choice of ways of going about it. And I'm writing a book about seeking a higher power.
To help those people who are struggling with that.
Which is a lot of people.
Yes,
and
it sure is.
It was me at one time. And I won't say that I found God, because I happen to agree that it's not possible to think about God as God is. But I do have an understanding that's comfortable for me. It's good enough. It's not going to get any better. It's good enough. I think it's just supposed to be good enough. Now, there are people that disagree with me, of course, and they have a very specific belief about God, and that's fine for them. It just doesn't work for me.
All right, great. One more question, and that is our signature question that we ask everybody on closing, and that is, if you could tell a younger version of yourself something about either addiction or 12-step program, what would it be?
Keep an open mind. It works. You're not as smart as you think you are.
Because we think we're so smart.
Oh, when I was 16, that's when you should have asked me anything, when I was 16. And my poor father was so dumb, but he got smarter as I got older.
All right. Okay. Michael, thank you so much for your time talking about your book, The 12-Step Pathway, A Heroic Journey of Recovery, and for sharing your thoughts about recovery in general.
I'm so happy that you asked me. It's a pleasure to have this conversation with you and have an opportunity to let your viewers learn about this idea and learn about my book. And I hope it helps somebody.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.